Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Welcome, my friends, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're glad you've tuned in to get squared. The solar wind is up to 441.6 kilometers per second. Again, no sunspots, but high-latitude sky watchers should be alert for auroras tonight. A solar wind stream is buffeting Earth's magnetic field and causing geomagnetic disturbances around the poles. On November 6th at 2132 UT, asteroid 2009 VA barely missed Earth when it flew just 14,000 kilometers above the planet's surface. That's well inside the Clark belt of geosynchronous satellites. If it had hit, the 6-meter-wide space rock would have disintegrated in the atmosphere as a spectacular fireball, causing no significant damage to the ground. 2009 VA was discovered just 15 hours before closest approach by astronomers working at the Catalina Sky Survey. 15 hours, not much warning out there. There were 22 earthquakes greater than 2.5 in the last 24 hours. Only 6 were greater than 5.0. Still very quiet inside the Earth. Leading physics researchers have recently announced the discovery of the heaviest chemical element yet known to science. The new element has been tentatively named governmentium. Governmentium has 1 neutron, 12 assistant neutrons, 75 deputy neutrons, and 224 assistant deputy neutrons, which are surrounded by vast quantities of lepton-like particles called pions. Since governmentium has no electrons, it is inert. However, it can be detected as it impedes every reaction with which it comes into contact by requiring 10 orders of magnitude more energy in than it could ever produce. A minute amount of governmentium causes one reaction to take over 4 days to complete, when it would normally take less than a second. Governmentium has a normal half-life of 3 years. It does not decay, but instead undergoes a reorganization in which a portion of the assistant neutrons and deputy neutrons exchange places. In fact, governmentium's mass will actually increase over time, since each reorganization will cause some morons to become neutrons, forming isotopes. This characteristic of moron promotion leads some scientists to speculate that governmentium is formed whenever morons reach a certain quantity in concentration. Interestingly enough, the hypothetical quantity is referred to as critical morass. You often hear us speak about global warming here on this program. We are open-minded to all evidence for or against, but it is the scientific mind that should prevail. While Al Gore flies around the globe, leaving a carbon footprint larger than himself, preaching the dangers of man-made global warming at $100,000 per appearance, real scientists are predicting an imminent ice age, At the end of the age, it is the sun that provides the best source of energy for a warming Earth. Quote, by the mid-21st century, the planet will face another little ice age similar to the Maunder Minimum, the previous little ice age. This is according to Kababiu Abdusamatov, head of the Russian Space Research Laboratory, told RIA Novosti in an interview just a few months ago. He said this will occur because the amount of solar radiation hitting the Earth has been constantly decreasing since the 1990s and will reach its minimum approximately in 2041. The impact of man's activities upon this equation are still being tallied, so we should be ever vigilant to use our resources wisely and not be the carbon straw that breaks the planet's back. There are a few things you can do to retain more of your hard-earned wages. This is free money that no one can take away from you, so listen up. Drive the speed limit. This will save money in fuel, traffic fines, insurance, and perhaps even a life or two. Also, stop smoking. You are spending between $100 and $400 a month for a smoking household. You won't have to make a choice between making a car payment on time or buying cigarettes if you quit. One last thing. Consider buying an electric car. For more information, click the electric car link at X Squared Radio. Tonight's guest is an astronomer, educator, and writer who has taught astronomy in colleges, at colleges and educational centers across the country for more than 20 years. He has worked for the Space Telescope Science Institute and been supervisor to the Williams College Observatory. He attended the graduate program in philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, California. He is qualified to be on X Squared Radio. We will be right back in 40 seconds with our guest, Stephen Martin, and his associate, Jim Gardner. Don't go away. 40 seconds. Whoops. Wrong soundbite. Hang on just one moment. Don't you love internet radio? We like internet radio. Here we go. We hope you have your seatbelts fastened, your tray tables in their upright and locked position, and your seat reclined. We are about to go into Cosmic Conversations, the book by Stephen Martin with his associate tonight, Jim Gardner. Welcome to the program, gentlemen. I hear rustling in the background. I know we have guests. Welcome, Stephen and Jim. How are you?
Hi, Brooks. Good to be here. This is Stephen.
And this is Jim. And I'm just doing great.
Awesome. The book Cosmic Conversations was a compilation of interviews that you did with various researchers, authors, physicists, instructors. I found it completely fascinating. You know, these great thinkers all had startling points of view for a set of profound questions that really have plagued mankind since the Earth cooled. How did you get the idea for the book, and how did you get involved?
Well, it's an interesting story because, you know, as an astronomer, I've studied the universe for a long time. And, you know, I'm supposedly an expert on the universe. But I woke up one night startled by the realization of how little I actually know about the universe. And in fact, you know, the question that came to me is, well, what actually is it? You know, I know it's atoms and energy and, you know, all these physical dynamics interacting, but what actually is it? And that's the question that stuck with me. And it kind of gnawed at me from in the back of my mind for many years. And I thought, well, if I don't know what it is, maybe someone else does. And so that's where the idea of going around talking to amazing figures and, you know, science, culture, the spiritual traditions, the indigenous peoples of the world, and asking them, what's their take on the universe? Maybe we'd find some interesting insights about what it is that we're actually involved here. And Jim Gardner, who's also on the show tonight, was one of these people. And I describe him more as a collaborator than an assistant, since we collaborated in one of these cosmic conversations and discovered some amazing things about the universe in the process.
Well, that's absolutely amazing. You know, sometimes we get too close to the trees to see the forest when it comes to the universe. I guess the one question one would ask is, how many realities are there? I mean, I think the answer, you know, is also a question. How many people are there? So what did you discover when you started asking people, what is the universe?
Well, I think you're on the right track with discovering that we're in basically a multi-perspectival reality. And the word that I use in the book is that our universe is omni-perspectival. In other words, there are many valid perspectives on whatever this phenomena is that we call the universe. And so, as you said, there may be as many valid perspectives as there are people. Because one of the insights that kept coming through in interview after interview with this book is that we do not live in the universe, but we actually are the universe itself. Therefore, I mean, it's a subtle shift in terms of semantics, but a big shift in terms of our consciousness and how we approach things. And that shift makes all the difference in recognizing that each one of us has, you know, our own perspective on what this reality is. And so we need a multiplicity to really start to get a handle on what it is we're involved with.
Well, a physicist might say that, you know, since the universe involves our perspective and thus our observation, are we not adding to the equation of the result by that observation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, we're discovering that the universe is enriching itself through, you know, our own work. So asking these questions is the process of the universe coming to know itself more fully. You know, I say itself, and I don't mean to be anthropomorphic, but just the idea that the universe is learning and growing and complexifying over time, and our actions are part of that shaping of its evolution.
Well, you know, the science, the religion, mysticism, even superstitious viewpoints can cross boundaries. So often through the equation, the rituals, the dances, and the myths, I guess. I think the answer is all of the above, don't you? They just kind of all mix together.
Very much so. And yet we could still have some discrimination about, you know, what is valid and what's not so valid. You know, for example, you know, within the perspective of modern science, you know, we're very, very focused on the aspects of matter and energy and how they interact in the universe, you know, the physicality of the universe. And yet in the spiritual traditions or in the indigenous traditions, they're not so much focused on that. Many indigenous cultures see the universe as composed of, I don't know what you call it, spiritual energy, intelligence, life, and that reality is somewhat permeable and morphic, and that it can be changed through language and ritual, as you mentioned. And then there are other, you know, even more different perspectives on the universe as well. So it doesn't seem like, even though we might have different perspectives that are very different, they don't necessarily have to be in conflict with each other.
Well, that's true. I totally agree with that. Although, you know, when it comes to validity or validating or the validating process, you know, the ordinary person would say, well, I don't own a telescope and I'm not really interested in astronomy. I don't meditate and I'm not really into, you know, soul searching. Uh-huh. And so I have what I think is a valid view of the universe. I think it stinks and it gets worse and then you die. And, you know, that's the summation of the validation from the casual observer, unawakened, uneducated, unexposed to the wonder of it all.
Sure.
But some would observe that we have looked very far into the universe and see that it is all the same. Galaxy after galaxy, cluster after cluster, supercluster after, you know what. Do you think it is still being created? And if so, by whom?
In other words, is the universe in the process of continual creation?
Yeah.
Some perspectives would say yes. Some would say that the universe is constantly being created every moment. Now, in science, you know, we have the leading theory of the Big Bang Theory, that the universe began, you know, some nearly 14 billion years ago from some singular event and has been evolving ever since. So,
well, evolution is different than creation. I mean, we would say, okay, the universe was created in a billionth of a second, and it's been evolving from pure energy into matter ever since.
Right.
I guess what I'm asking is creation still occurring? In other words, did the creation finish, and now the whole universe is just evolving, or is creation continuous?
It's a good question, and some of my contributors would say yes, and some might say no, not necessarily, or we don't know. And I think, once again, it depends on what you're attuned to. I mean, atoms, you know, from what we understand, seem to be stable over time, at least what we call atoms. Now, whether they're being created freshly in each moment, and so they simply appear to be the same atom, you know, second by second by second, is still an open question.
This is Jim. Let me jump in, if I may.
Yeah,
so there is a leading theory of cosmogenesis, which is a fancy term that refers to the process by which the cosmos is created. A leading theory that's called eternal chaotic inflation, which postulates that the Big Bang was not a one-off event, but one in a series of Big Bangs which are continuously going off in inaccessible regions and creating, in effect, new universes constantly. And the entire ensemble is referred to as a multiverse.
I mean, it's such a mind-boggling perspective that universes could just be bubbling into existence moment by moment. I mean, that...
We kind of see that on a quantum level, too. We see photons popping into existence from what it seems to be other dimensions. And maybe, you know, protons do that and neutrons do that, too, on a subatomic basis. All protons are not the same. And, you know, there's a population of weights and measures for protons, ranging from hydrogen all the way down to iron and back up to the heavier elements. But I guess the point is, or the observation is, you're right. I mean, if you just want to look at this from a Heisenberg point of view, saying, well, we can't identify the location and speed of any particle, let alone a proton or a neutron, maybe it's not exactly the same proton that's been in that nail that holds my house together as the one where it was smelted.
Right. And, you know, there actually was, you know, a leading competitor to the Big Bang Theory for many years, which was proposed by astronomer Fred Hoyle, called, you know, the theory of continuous creation, that matter was constantly being created into existence moment by moment by moment. And that theory has fallen out of favor in the mainstream, but, you know, it's one of the alternatives to the Big Bang. And perhaps it's not necessarily incompatible, you know, with the idea that the universe begins as a singular event.
Well, we're kind of assuming that the universe is what we can see. There's, you know, 94%+ of the mass of the universe we can't see. We can't detect it. It's either super bright or super dark. We can't decide which.
Right.
But dark energy and dark matter could be transforming or crossing the, or should I say, collapsing into three dimensions where we can perceive it all the time.
Certainly. And, you know, what is dark matter and dark energy themselves? I mean, as you said, I mean, perhaps it is some larger dimensional phenomenon that we're not quite seeing in its true form. We're only seeing the effects of in our universe.
Well, that's a good question. Let's talk about that for a little bit. What is dark energy and dark matter besides the rest of the mass of the universe?
I mean that's, you know, that's the million-dollar question in, you know, physics and astrophysics right now. I mean, what actually is it? Are these even valid terms for it? You know, we call it dark matter because it exerts gravitational force on visible matter the way that we see, you know, normal matter does. But is it truly matter, or are we simply seeing some new expression of gravity? That's, you know, that's the unsolved mystery at this point.
Then this is Jim again. There are theories now, speculative theories, that say that what we observe as dark energy, the sort of outward pressure at very large distances of the cosmos, that's really the consequence of the leakage of gravity into unseen extra dimensions, into the 11 dimensions proposed by M theory, that gravity is sort of draining out of our visible universe, and that's causing that expansion to occur.
Mm-hmm. And that could also explain why gravity, the gravitational force, is so weak compared with the other fundamental forces.
Yeah, yes, exactly so.
Yeah.
Well, lest our listeners think this is some astrophysics think tank, let me throw out a couple definitions there. Brain theory, from what I understand, is short for membrane theory. It's
correct.
As opposed to, or at least in addition to, string theory, that the universe exists as a series of layers of an onion, shall we say, and each one of those layers is a membrane, and so the interactions between membranes is called brain theory, just like string theory was, I don't know, what, 26 different dimensions all interacting with one another to make the equations of reality, relativity, actually work out and not be self-destructive or end up with answers like infinity. So that's what that means. An interesting thought is that, you know, on the one hand, we look at it as sort of two weights at the opposite end of a string, and they're flinging around each other in space so that one creates the orbit of the other. And the string, or the rope between the two weights, happens to go between the veil into another dimension. Mm-hmm. That's one way to look at it. And the other is, like you said, that outward pressure. I'm going to make a bumper sticker out of that. Gravitational leakage. I really like that term. That's just mind-boggling enough to make the driver in back of me be distracted, which could be dangerous. a lot of neat terms coming out of tonight. I'm definitely writing that one down and putting it above my desk in my office. Now entering gravitational leakage.
The
fascinating thing is that when we look back through the time of the ancients, the Babylonian seals, the Akkadian drawings, going back as far as the Sumerians, We see some very profound observations, although they had somewhat of a, sometimes a mythological and sometimes a religious tint to them, the relationships were very profound, and they're not unlike what we're talking about right now. What did you discover as you were interviewing about some of your subjects' perspectives on what the ancients thought about what we're just now discovering?
Well, the indigenous peoples that I interviewed, you know, all spoke out very strongly about this, about the importance of the ancestors. In other words, they trace their lineage back through, you know, a long line of ancestors that are very important, you know, even, you know, in daily life. And so ritual for indigenous peoples is, in many ways, like the scientific instruments of modern science. So instead of looking at the universe through a microscope or a telescope, they look at it through the container of ritual. In other words, it seems to be a methodology for changing consciousness and for providing a very different perspective on the universe than what we're used to. And so I think the ancients understood this. I mean, they understood the importance of both the mythological realm, its effect on the human psyche, and also the importance of ritual. And I think that's been carried down through us, even in Western culture in many ways. But it's something that indigenous cultures have very strongly carried with them. The other
I think it's definitely obvious that they understood something. I mean, when they're doing a dance and you ask them, what does this dance mean? Oh, this is where the Earth came through a wormhole in space and appeared in our area on the Milky Way galaxy. And you're going, what? What do you mean a wormhole? Where did you learn about that? How could you figure that out from rubbing two sticks together to make fire?
Exactly. And we may think that they're talking, you know, metaphorically or mythologically, but, you know, we can also consider the possibility that that may actually be the perception from a ritual perspective.
Well, maybe it could be the degradation of ancient scientific instruction, because the people that knew how to do stuff, knew how to understand that and teach that, passed away. And so the ones that inherited it turned it into a dance or a ritual. But the coincidence is just striking. It's too perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that could be true. I mean, what was preserved as, you know, secret knowledge in the mystery schools may have somehow gotten corrupted once it leaked out into the larger population. That's possible. The other thing that's, you know, central of importance for, you know, the indigenous peoples that I interviewed was the idea of interrelationship. That, you know, we do not exist as individuals, you know, in a vacuum or a void, but we're basically part of a network of interrelationships. That what we do affects the Earth, and what happens to the Earth affects us. And they had this profound understanding of interrelatedness that was very different than I was used to, you know, having grown up in a Western culture. And it's just a very, very different perspective on the cosmos and of the Earth community as well.
Well, Jim, let me ask you a question. As one ruminates after crying, trying to learn the mathematics of physics, as to what the concept is, what the relationship is, what is the picture of the equation I'm trying to figure out here, I'm trying to understand well enough to pass my instructor's final exam, there seems to be kind of I'm going to call it a download, almost like a dream state that comes over you, and then you grasp this concept. And when I instruct in chemistry, you see students learning the language of stoichiometry, and they kind of go along in a fog for a while, and then boom, the light goes on. And as an instructor, you could see the light go on in that person. Oh, they finally get it. And then their grades go from C- to B+ because they understand the concept. That point in the universe where we either reach out to or reach inside ourselves, when we begin to understand the universe, we begin to understand even the more complex relationships as we jump from chemistry into physics. Do you think it's the same for the indigenous people as it is for the scientist as he becomes a scientist?
In a way, I think it is. I think that we build upon the knowledge and insights that have come before us, and we essentially reprocess those as raw ingredients for modern theories of science. And I'll give you an example. The debate over extraterrestrial life, which I write about a fair amount in my book, that debate is ancient. It goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks. And the concepts continue to get sort of reprocessed over the centuries. So we each experience maybe different aha moments when our insights are illuminated with the tools of mathematics, or more equally important, the observational capacities that we have now achieved through marvelous instruments like the Hubble Space Telescope. But the basic ideas are very ancient in many cases.
Well, I know they're ancient, but I mean, even when you look at the modern 19-year-old who you know is in college for the first time and he's being exposed to things well beyond what he was exposed to in high school. He may be taking his first physics class, for that matter. And something occurs where it's almost like truth exists universally out there. And whether we reach out and tap into it as a musician or an artist or a mason or a chemist or a carpenter or an architect, that concept comes in and is interpreted based on our own psyche, our own desire, or the own, like you said, the mathematical tools that we possess at the time. But there are instances when pure, finished concepts come into one's mind. Chandrasekhar comes to mind, where mathematical training, and yet he was downloading whole math that took literally decades for trained mathematicians to derive. Nevertheless, they were true. So where did they come from?
Yeah, that's a great mystery. Ramanujan is another example, the great Indian mathematician. And there seems to be in some individuals this incredible capacity to basically transcribe and help articulate very profound ideas that they really should not have access to in theory.
Well, it was just a range of questions. I just kind of want to set the tone, because as we get into these interviews, these incredible interviews that you had with these, I'm just going to call them leaders in various sciences, they each had different perspectives. They each had different ways of answering the questions that you asked. And so I just wanted to kind of set the groundwork that, even the listeners out there are eminently qualified to answer any one of these questions from their perspective, because they are involved in the universe. And I'm going to discuss that involvement and that from a mathematical point of view and even from a consciousness point of view. Now, several of your interviewees responded to complex questions about the universe with terms like consciousness. What did you discover about the importance of consciousness in the formation of the universe?
Well, it's interesting. In many cases, some of these people I interviewed had no choice but to use the word consciousness or intent when talking about the dynamics of the universe. You know, what comes to mind is the interview with Dean Radin, who I'm sure you're familiar with and many of your listeners are as well. You know, he's a well-known researcher and parapsychologist at the Institute for Noetic Sciences. And, through his very careful experiments, he's found that something like intent or consciousness seems to have a shaping effect on the world. You know, it's very, very subtle, and so you need, very precise experiments to detect its effects. But yet, he has no choice but to admit that there's something happening here that indicates that there's more than meets the eye. In other words, just explaining the results with what we know about the interaction of matter and energy isn't enough. Somehow, whether you call it consciousness or intent, or some sort of mental influence seems to play a shaping role in the physical world, even at a very subtle level. He said at one point in the interview, he knows he's, sounding like a mystic or a meditation teacher, but he doesn't know how else to put it, that consciousness, whatever that is, seems to be an important aspect of the world. And as many people know, from the perspective of quantum physics, the idea of the observer comes in, that the observer is an integral aspect of the experiment. And so consciousness, once again, seems to want to find its way into the door, through the back door, even into physics. And I think that's a profound insight, that we don't quite understand both what consciousness is and also where it comes into this whole thing that we're calling the universe.
Well, you know, just so our listeners can keep, you know, up with us, when we talk about observation, in science we like to use instruments. We like to use micrometers, and we use spectrometers, and we use even atomic force microscopy, which is kind of a atomic phonograph needle that feels its way over the morphology of something and then uses a computer to draw a picture of it. By touching or by bombarding or even by noticing with our consciousness, we alter the universe slightly. If we bombard it with electrons, the image that we get back isn't really the image of, say, the pollen particle. It's been degraded somewhat by the bombardment process of the electrons. If we observe something as small as a photon, we change it from a wave to a particle. It's very difficult to get in there and look at the universe without changing it. Well, the act of observation, when you tie it up with human intent, which is coupled with things like desire and things like free thought and intention, now you've got sort of a baseball bat in a china shop, which can result in either very chaotic events, like all the china in the shop getting broken, or very organizational things, like structure being built and beauty coming out of chaos. And all those effects are a result of the consciousness of sentient beings. So I guess my question to you is, do you think that there are, in your opinion, or maybe in your knowledge, do you think there are more than just humans as sentient beings on our planet or in our part of the neighborhood?
I think so. I mean, I don't know, you know, if you're referring to extraterrestrials, but I think that's a possibility that they may be contributing to the sentience of the universe. But we know, for example, that many of the species on our planet are highly intelligent and sentient, and have some degree of self, you know, reflexive awareness as we do. So we know for certain that we're not the only sentient beings on the planet, and, you know, perhaps there are other species that are also playing a shaping role through the influence of consciousness. I think
one that comes to mind is dolphins and whales, of course.
Of course, of course. I mean, all, you know, these higher primates and mammals, you know, share a lot in terms of their capacity for, you know, learning, intelligence, and, you know, organization of communities. And so we have a lot more in common with them than we think. And so our interactions with them are very important as well. Perhaps they're playing a shaping role in those relationships as well.
Well, yeah, we have not only interaction with them, but we also have an interaction with generations of humans that have gone before us. We as, shall I call us, modern space-age humans or atomic-age humans, have a tendency to look at ancient civilizations on this Earth as being primitive, but far from it. Highly complex, very organized, and very focused, which is something we are not. So who's the primitive?
Yeah, I mean, these civilizations that we call primitive, you know, built things like the pyramids. I mean, just, you know, astonishing works of art, you know, architecture and engineering. And they made out of conceptualized science and technology in the way that we do in modern times, but they certainly had their, you know, extremely efficient methods of interacting with the universe in very successful ways.
Well, they also had a social way of organizing themselves. I mean, we can't even agree from beginning to end of the building of a bridge, let alone a pyramid over several generations handed off to perhaps three or four generations of engineers, and yet it came out right.
Yeah, I mean, that's an astonishing achievement in social organization, you know, much less in engineering. And so perhaps they have a lot to teach us about, you know, collective intelligence, about these organizational aspects that, you know, seem to be emergent properties when groups of people come together with a common intent. And I know that's something that Jim talks about in his book as well, this idea that collective intelligence is something that's emerging on our planet right now.
Yes, and I think the phenomenon of the Internet has often been likened to the growth of a nervous system in biology.
Yeah, I mean, these communications networks, you know, seem to grow, you know, almost like dendrites in the brain. So it's interesting that similar structures show up on different levels of organization.
You know, we human beings are driven to sociology. We organize ourselves in communities. We don't scatter ourselves equidistantly around the planet. We like to group ourselves together. But the problem is that when we get too many of us in one place at one time, we make a mess. We have a tendency to pollute terribly, and we don't, you know, take care of the environment very well. But that urge to socialize, the urge to come together and collaborate in real time, to speak with one another, to see one another, to trade ideas with one another, is definitely being satisfied by the Internet, which allows the physical bodies to be separated equidistantly around the planet, as long as, of course, we have a Wi-Fi connection.
Correct. Very important.
Oh, my gosh. And not dial-up either. Oh, no, it would have to be high speed. But it is. I think it's going to change the sociology in the next 10 or 20 years, don't you?
I think very much so. I mean, go ahead.
I think, well, it's actually, there's new science now that shows that use of devices, of cell phones, the constant use of smartphones, it actually reshapes the topology, the structure of the brain. It reorganizes the way your brain is physically organized.
You know, I'd also heard a statistic about that, is that the brains of many teenagers today, their prefrontal or frontal cortexes are about 10% larger than they have been in the past.
That's exactly what my teenagers are trying to tell me.
You see, they're the cutting edge of evolution right now.
Well, that's
amazing. I think something profound is going on, and that has to do with the pervasiveness of the Internet. I don't think there's any question about it.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right, because like 130 years ago, this urge to socialize, communicate, get important messages and important discoveries from one place to another was satisfied by the Pony Express, which is only slightly faster than dial-up, but not much. At least it seems that way. You have to go eat dinner when you're downloading your emails. But with the advent of faster speeds, it almost gets real time. I mean, I don't know the physical location that you all are in at the moment, but we're having a discussion as though we're in the same room with one another. I'm at the foothills of the Smokies in the U.S., and we have listeners all over the world, from Australia to California to Canada to Texas, listening to us live. And in about 11 minutes, we're going to allow them to call in and ask questions if they dare do so. We're trying. We promise we'll go through a syllable reduction program here in the next 10 minutes, and we can allow everyone to participate. That was a joke. one of the questions I want to ask is, and it's really answered in your book. Because and from several different perspectives, the name of the book is Cosmic Conversations, and of course the author is it Stephen or Stephen Martin?
It's a Stephen.
Okay, Stephen Martin, but it's spelled Stephan.
That's
and
right.
I'll do this several times tonight. How can they get the book, Stephen?
Well, they can order it from their local bookstore. It's also available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. And if they want more information about the book or the contributors in the book, they can go to www.cosmicconversations.org. And there's information about the collaborators, about the book itself, and where they can find it.
Okay, great. And we'll do that every hour. And by the way, in the next hour, we will open the phone line. So if you want to be part of the program, toll-free, anywhere where you have toll-free service, it's 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. And if you don't have toll-free service, sometimes in Europe or Australia, you can't dial toll-free. But you can reach us by regular phone. That is 530-776-5154. If you're on planet, off planet, makes no difference to us. Just get close to a cell phone tower, give us a call, and weigh in your question. We'll shift gears in the second hour, and we're going to try to tackle three simple subjects. I'm going to ask the question, do time, space, and matter really exist? And there's a hint. It's not a yes or no answer. So it will probably take an hour just to go through that question, because there are several different perspectives from which we can look at this. In the very first part of this hour, we asked the question, what is the universe? And we've been talking about it now for about 50 minutes. Are we any closer now to understanding what the universe is than we were when we started?
I think so. I mean, I think, through this process of dialogue, through the process of conversation, we discover more about the universe. So I think, and I know that, Jim also holds this view that the universe, in some sense, is a learning system, right? It's growing, it's evolving, it's learning over time. And so I see, this book is not a static collection of interviews, but really an invitation for people to begin their own conversations, to discover for themselves what is the universe, both on their own and in dialogue with others. And so I say that anyone can actually have a cosmic conversation. Talk to the person next to you. You'll find they may live in an entirely different universe than you do. I mean, they say men are from Mars and, women are from Venus, right? So there's these different perspectives that we all inhabit. And it's a joyful process of discovering, what is the universe for each of us.
What about you, Jim?
Well, the way I put it is that to take liberties with the old ballad, we are the world, we are the people, and we are the universe, or to state it from the opposite perspective, the universe is actually coming to life and coming to consciousness through the mechanisms of our lives and our minds.
Well, 250 years ago, we were somewhat anthropocentric in that the sun revolved around us. We were the only beings in the universe, and so therefore we must be the center of it. I don't think any of our listeners believe that anymore. In fact, I think if anyone, a shaman, a priest, or a president were to come to us and tell us that, we would just not believe it. That being the case, are we spectators in the universe? Are we?
No, I think we're co-participants, and I totally agree with the fact that we have shed our anthropocentric biases. But the way that I conceive of our role, first, I don't think that we're alone in the cosmos. I do think it's highly likely that we share it not only with the creatures of the earthly biosystem, but with extraterrestrial life. And our role is not to be the be-all and end-all, the center of creation. It's more like the role played by mitochondria, which are tiny little organelles within cells. We're part of a vast community of emergent life that essentially helps the universe come to life and come to self-awareness.
Well, are you talking about the biological transducer, which is the human body, or are you talking about the being inside?
I'm talking about the really at all levels of biology, including the community and the internet. All of those levels are part and parcel of the basic cosmic processes. That's why I use the phrase, we are the cosmos. We are the kind of leading edge of the emergence of intelligence, at least on this planet.
Well, let me ask you a question about that group of intelligence itself. Do you think that that has always existed along with the Big Bang, or do you think that intelligence is always in a state of creation?
The latter, always in a state of creation.
Ah, okay. So there are very ancient intelligences in the universe, and there are also very young intelligences in the universe.
Yes, I think so, yes.
Yeah, I like that. And some are right here in this town, as a matter of fact, probably in yours too.
Yep.
What does the universe look like from the perspective of the speed of light? In other words, if you were going the speed of light, what would the universe look like?
That's a fascinating question that, you know, Einstein asked, and that's really the question that led him to the theory of relativity. He tried to imagine what would it actually be like to actually ride on a beam of light. And, you know, it turns out that the results are very interesting. You know, for example, photons, which are basically particles of light, are essentially immortal. Because, as Einstein said, because of time dilation, time actually stops at the speed of light. So if you were to travel, you know, across the universe, you know, on a light beam, it would be an instantaneous journey. There would be simply no time at all between when you left and when you got there. And because time and space are intertwined through Einstein's theory of relativity, it would also be as if there were no distance covered, you know, from the perspective of light. So it's interesting that the experience of the universe from the perspective of light is instantaneity. In other words, it's always instantaneous. It's always in the now.
There you go. And not saying that you could step out the universe, outside the universe, because relativity is only a viewpoint of everything that's inside the universe relative
right.
to everything else. But if you could step outside and look at the universe, then the Hamiltonian would be zero, right?
Right, right.
Kinetic energy plus potential energy, one negative, one positive, you get a big zero. So really the whole universe becomes now. The whole universe becomes knowable, becomes that photon becomes omnipresent, becomes omniscient.
Mm-hmm. And because a photon acts like a quantum particle, it actually exists simultaneously everywhere in the universe until it is actually observed and actualized. So it's there in potential everywhere, which is a very interesting thing to think about.
So when we're thinking about the universe and the fact that we are observing it and also participants in it, are we not, as beings in the universe, empowered to slow everything down so that we can savor it like a good dish instead of knowing it all at once?
I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot happening in every moment that we tend to overlook because we don't necessarily think it's important. But everything is the universe happening right now. And I think there's a lot going on around us that we don't always appreciate.
Now that is exciting stuff.
Yeah.
I like it. Wow. We could go a lot of places in our next hour. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a let's take a 4-minute break. Let everybody get a drink of water. We will return with more X Squared Radio in about 4 minutes. So just take a quick break, listen to music, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio.
Make me a witness. Take me intention won't make fire out of clay.
welcome back to X Squared Radio, second hour. This is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, be sure to let us know. We'll get with your affiliate and make sure that they carry all 3 hours. This is the month where we have a responsibility to reflect on the things that we have, who we are, what we're capable of doing, what our potential is, and don't save it up for Thanksgiving Day, because that's going to be covered up with gravy and football. Try to start now and realize that you live in a time, in an age, when the concept called the American Dream is not only in the hands of every American, but it's in the hand of, in the laps of every being on the face of the earth. Although there are populations who have to walk a day to get to a telephone, the idea that thought and ideas and concepts and discoveries can be spread from person to person faster now than ever before. We used to, centuries ago, complain that it was access to knowledge that separated countries and aristocracies within those countries. And now access to knowledge is imparted to all. And now it is the struggle for access to capital. Not because of what we do or because of what we are, but because of what we want to have. And I would ask you to be thankful for the first two and not pay so much attention to the latter. Because at the end of the day, it really isn't what we have that separates us, that esteems us, that gives us self-worth. It is what we are, and it is what we do. The doing is getting up off one's posterior and participating in the experience of life. Whether you are an artist or an athlete, whether you are a pilot or a scuba diver, a photographer or a teacher, do it with everything you have and be thankful that you are able to do that instead of having to grow your own peas and carrots, weave your own clothes, and build your own house. We have specialized our societies much like the cells of a body, and we can now realize the fullness of whatever potential we desire in this life. That is what I implore you to be thankful for this month. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Stephen Martin, Jim Gardner, we're discussing the book Cosmic Conversations.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
What is the fastest thing in the universe? The stuff of comic book lore. Is it light? Good question. We were discussing that in our last hour in the perspective of the universe from the cockpit of a photon. But I would ask you, Stephen, some people think that thought is faster than light. What would you say?
I think it's an interesting idea that we're just learning about. We don't really know what the speed of thought is, especially in the global system that's emerging. You know, we know that signals travel over the internet at the speed of light, and information travels to us. You know, at least in the physical world, you know, at the speed of light. But I think the speed of thought might be something else entirely together. We're still, you know, in the very infant stages of learning, you know, what is thought is, what is thought, what are its properties, how do we actually discover more about it, how do we understand thought.
One of your interviewees was Edgar Mitchell.
Yes.
A lot of people don't know this. Even though he was an astronaut, he was also, of course, as a founder of Noetic Sciences, he was also very much into... shall I say things more esoteric? He conducted an experiment during his trip to the moon. Did he talk to you a little bit about that experiment?
He mentioned it just briefly. I think, you'll have to correct me, but I think he was doing some kind of telepathy experiment while he was on board with subjects on Earth. And, you know, I don't know.
It was a quantitative experiment to prove or disprove whether telepathy could leave the bounds of one planet and go to another. And the interesting, well, except for the fact that, that Olaf Johnson leaked the experiment and kind of ruined the post-experimental data treatment part of it, the interesting thing was that it defied all odds, to be sure. The images that were transmitted by thought from Earth to the orbit of the moon were in fact received by Edgar Mitchell and written down upon his pad while he was orbiting the moon.
Fascinating. Yeah. And I actually did ask him a follow-up question about that, that did he think that perhaps we might travel one day throughout the universe without the use of physical bodies? In other words, could we travel throughout the universe mentally or through thought? And his response was that we'll still need spaceships because we'll still need to bring physical bodies with us. But it doesn't mean that we may not perhaps be able to see, you know, different parts of the universe through, you know, remote viewing or other non-physical methods.
You know, interesting.
As his telepathic experiment, you know, perhaps demonstrates.
By the way, I did want to remind the listeners that the phone lines are now open, so if you want to call and be part of the program, you can. The number, if you have toll-free service where you are, 888-228-4494. That'll work anywhere in North America. If you just want to get close to a cell phone tower, you got free nights and weekends, or you just want to call in for a few minutes and leave a question, 530-776-5154. Jim, there's some empirical data out there. It's the testing of the theory of entangled particles.
Yes.
Can you help us explain that?
Well, that, and it relates to your question of what's the fastest thing in the universe. If a measurement or an observation is made of two subatomic particles, which have been essentially linked at birth, think of them as intimate twins, then the twin particle, even though it may be light years away from its from the other twin, it will be affected instantaneously, far more quickly than would have occurred if you were limited by the speed of light. And that's a profound mystery. But it's been verified experimentally now over distances of kilometers.
Right. I think, what is it, the aspect experiment, the 11-kilometer
yes.
separation of two beryllium ions.
Yes.
I took Jim Bell is the guy that runs the rovers up on Mars, and I was talking to him one night on this program, and I said, "What's the big frustration, you know, in the project? Because the robots have lived a lot longer than they were supposed to, and they're trying to figure out things to do with them because they've outlived the original experiment, and now they're looking at stars from Mars perspective by tilting the camera back and looking up into space and taking long exposures, but." He said the frustrating thing is that they have to send the command to Marsis, which is the orbiting satellite, and Marsis picks up the message and then goes around the other side of the planet where the rover is, gives the data string to the rover then acts on it, and then when Marsis comes back around, gives the data to Marsis, Marsis goes around Earth's side of Mars, broadcasts it to Earth. It takes about 8 minutes to get here. He said, you think dial-up is slow? It's
yeah.
really hard to drive the robots around and get, you know, things going. I said, why don't you use a beryllium ion modem?
Yeah.
Exactly.
People have thought about that. But there's a and it does get really too technical. This does get too technical, but you cannot encode information using sort of what's called spooky action at a distance. So it's at least as far as we know. I'm still a bit of a skeptic in saying you can never do it, but the conventional wisdom is that the phenomenon exists, but it cannot be used as a modem.
Right. Because observing the photon at the receiving end would also negate the...
That's it. Yeah, it'll screw up any coding mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah, Einstein's frustration. The moon exists because a mouse looked at it.
Yeah.
is it man's creation to slow the universe down so distance and time emerge like these flavors in some exquisite dish?
It's a good question. You know, I've heard that in some of the spiritual traditions of the world, one of the purposes of meditation is to actually slow the mind down enough so that it can actually see the universe in the act of creation. In other words, the universe is being created, you know, at a very rapid rate, you know, much faster than the refresh rate of our usual minds and our perceptual systems. But, you know, these ancient traditions say if you can slow the mind down, you can actually watch directly the actual manifestation of the universe on a moment-to-moment basis. And one of my contributors, Dwayne Elgin, talked about this. I mean, he's been an experienced meditator for many years, and he talked about the capacity of the mind, you know, once it's slowed down, to actually perceive things in this way. Another person I interviewed, Lama Paulbin, who's a Buddhist Lama, she also talks about this capacity. It's just, so we're still really tapping into the tremendous power of the human mind and what its capacities are in terms of perceiving the universe directly and, you know, perhaps, you know, new potentials that have yet to emerge.
Well, do you think those perceptions have an effect on the universe?
They certainly could. I don't think it's out of the question, you know, especially if, mind and matter somehow mysteriously interrelate. And what's the effect of not just mind, but consciousness or the conscious mind? I think that's still very much an open question. And, we're really at the shore of this great ocean of discovery about the potential of that.
I have a listener who says that she has always wanted to attain the point where she could manifest an apple and have it drop out of thin air into her hand. And I have cautioned her in the past as we've spoken on the phone that, you know, Buddha said to someone who was trying to learn to walk on water to cross the pond, why don't you just use the bridge? The idea of manifesting an apple when it would be so simple to walk over the tree and pick an apple, there's such a thing as the necessity of the universe, which you are circumventing by your act of shortcutting creation to satiate your own desires.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that on so many levels, whether we're trying to manifest an apple or $1 million. One would say that the bounty of the universe is limitless. And how do we access that? And that seems to be, I know Fred Allen Wolf was in the movie What the Bleep. And that movie seemed to be sort of an outgrowth of the publication of The Secret, in the sense that there is some law of attraction, some way in which we affect the universe by our negative or positive intentions, by our selfish or benevolent methodologies. And that if we were awake to that fact and purposeful with that fact, that we could actually participate more effectively in creation. So if this perception of the universe, this perception process is actually part of the creation process, I would say that your contributors that are experts at meditation are on the more enlightened side. And the ones that are picking up their battle axes and running across the frozen tundra at one another are not enlightened. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I think many of the spiritual traditions would say that, enlightenment is the natural state of the universe. We just simply have to realize that. But the idea of, approaching one another with battle axes seems to stem from a misunderstanding about the universe that many of these spiritual traditions speak to, and that is the perspective of unity, that the universe, in some deep, mysterious way, is a fundamental unity. In other words, there's some aspect of oneness that seems to be fundamental to the universe. And perhaps some aspect of this is something that we're discovering with the aspect experiments, with the entanglement experiments. Now, why we experience that oneness or that unity, through the mind, through consciousness directly, and how we can actually experience that directly, but we haven't quite caught up with the physics of that yet, we don't quite know. In other words, we discover entanglement happens, to atoms or quantum particles only in specific experimental situations. We can't say, the physical universe, acts as one, because there clearly are, different parts that are interrelating. From a spiritual perspective, all the collaborators I talked with said unanimously, yes, the universe is one. It's just a single event, a single entity, as you will.
On the other hand, there's antimatter and matter coming together. There's constructive and destructive interference. There's chaos and there's, coagulation. So even though it's all one, you still have, on some respect, even on a subatomic level, conflict.
Yes.
I was going to mention that another person who takes the view that in effect the emergence of the universe is a unitary quantum phenomenon is Stephen Hawking, and that there is a very deep linkage right from the get-go, but there are different paths that are being explored as the process of complexity emerges.
That's a good point, because there's still speculation about whether the initial state of the universe was correlated at a quantum level, and do those correlations maintain themselves, over the expansion and the evolution of the universe in ways that we have yet to discover. I don't think we quite know, what the initial state of matter was or what its properties were, but that may be what Stephen Hawking's pointing to.
Well, on the other hand, it's interesting to contemplate the idea that we moved from a point of very high entropy to what looks like low entropy, and now we're going back in the other direction, although not symmetrically. And that could be also the act of a supernova. When a supernova occurs, everything within at least a reasonable radius of the blast is changed into pure energy, and then collapses back into fresh new matter, higher order elements, and the whole thing starts over again. One would argue that all the matter created in that supernova event is entangled, but in the mixing of the universe, it kind of gets spread around, and so it's no longer entangled, at least in the local neighborhood.
Right.
But the concept of locality, though, or non-locality, that is to say, two particles separated by light years would interact instantaneously, empirically indicates that there's some subspace localness to this that we can actually observe in this universe. And
mm-hmm.
That's the most profound thing about this experiment.
Yes, yes. I mean,
it's trying to tell us something about the essential non-locality of this cosmos that we observe to be so local.
Yes, yes, and it's also calling into question, well, what is actually space? We consider it to be you know, that which separates objects so that they all don't run together. But what actually is it? You know, is Einstein correct in that it's a fabric, or it acts like a fabric? But we're discovering now, I think through modern physics, that we really don't have a very fundamental understanding of space itself. We've focused our research very strongly on particles as individual entities, and we haven't quite paid as much attention to what is the properties of the space in between those entities. And this could be part of what these experiments are starting to hint at, this
sure.
non-locality that could be a property of the space.
One of the properties of what's observed to be UFOs is that they don't necessarily fly from point A to point B. They more or less dissolve and then reappear somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And although they may fly very quickly in one direction, it seems they can make a left-hand turn at Mach 8 without smashing the occupants up against the driver window.
Right.
So there's something to be said that we don't quite understand the interpolation between the laws of thermodynamics. There must be a law 2.5 somewhere between 2 and 3 where we can make those left end turns without getting smashed.
Exactly.
Because it appears that there are ships doing it of some size and mass.
And right, you know, we do know at the subatomic level that that there is a phenomenon of called a transluminal teleportation, whereby a subatomic particle can essentially start off at the front of a barrier and then almost miraculously reappear on the other side of the barrier, having somehow moved perhaps not through it, but taken a shortcut at a speed that exceeds the speed of light. That's a documented phenomenon.
Oh, sure. I mean, even the, you know, electronics in modern computers work on that phenomenon. I mean, these transistors use these quantum effects in the electronics. So, I mean, it's not just documented, but it's part of our everyday lives, really, as well. The capacity of these particles to actually tunnel through barriers, which they couldn't otherwise do in a classical scenario.
Because the barrier was too dense to actually fit between the molecules like lead or gold or something, and then all of a sudden they're on the other side.
Right, right.
And they're much larger than a neutrino, so they couldn't just squeak in between.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's called quantum tunneling.
I like it. Sounds like a good name for a rock band. Some say that the entire universe is folded up inside of us. Are we unconscious to this presumption as a race?
Well, I mean, that seems to be, you know, one of the core teachings of many of these spiritual traditions, is that the universe is both outside and also inside. And, you know, one of these universal teachings, you know, so to speak, is that there's a vast universe of, you know, what you call a consciousness of awareness, you know, inside of us that seems to be, you know, even larger than the universe we experience outside of us. And how they relate together, I think, is still being discovered. You know, it's interesting, the interrelationship between, say, the inner world of the psyche and the outer world of the cosmos and our daily events.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I can just follow on that just briefly. One of my contributors, you know, at the very end of the book, Richard Tarnas, talks about this with Jung's concept of synchronicity. In other words, meaningful events seem to happen for individuals in very specific ways. You know, someone will come across just the right person at just the right time in a way that's meaningful for them. So there's some correlation between the development of their psyche and the action of the external world around them, which seems very mysterious. And but it's something that you know, Jung pointed to.
So this synchronicity, I hear the term bantied about, you know, because coincidence is sometimes just a little too odd. But in history, we see it as well. Case in point, if you go back into Tibetan Buddhism, back to the 7th century, somewhere around 640, King Gampo decides to form a brand new form of Buddhism called Tibetan Buddhism. And it is really revolutionary, although it consolidates some of the other Buddhisms around the other nations that he had recently conquered. There were some very innovative things about it, too. And one of the structures that came out of that was a structure known as the stupa. And the stupa, if you you can go to my Facebook page and see a photograph I took of one, which I don't think anyone in the West has actually seen this, because I was the first person to go through the door since 1959 and get the shot. But it is basically 4,300 pounds of gold, has 10,000 gems on it, and it has a striking resemblance to a Tesla coil. It doesn't function, but it looks like one. It even has the stylized lightning or electricity coming out at about a 30-degree angle downward on either side, with ribbons wrapped around it like, this is what we saw, and this is the best rendition we can come up with, okay? And then Tesla sees the same thing in the late 1800s and builds one. This is synchronicity in the sense that both of these individuals got this vision of this finished thing, or maybe they even saw it demonstrated. King Gampo built a stylized one with jewels and gold and called it a stupa, which is aimed at a four-dimensional stargate on the ceiling of the building in which it is interned. And Tesla said, I know how to build that and make it work with electricity. That is synchronicity. That the right idea comes to the right person with the right skill set, and it works.
Yes, and there's other examples throughout history. I mean, for example, the invention of the calculus, you know, was invented by Newton in England and by Leibniz, you know, in a similar way, and on the continent of Europe. So it's interesting that, you know, these kinds of ideas come into the world, you know, when their time is right.
And one would ask, from where?
Yeah. That's a good question.
We're not the answer of this program. we often say on this program that the universe is the mathematical sum of the intentions of every sentient being in the universe. And with such a large population, statistically speaking, it would seem unlikely that the average condition could actually be changed. Do you think it's possible to shift the average of the universe with an awakened human race?
I think so, and I think, you know, many of my contributors would agree, but it's very difficult from our average mode of consciousness because a lot of our thoughts tend to cancel each other out, whether consciously or unconsciously. You know, and you know, parapsychologist Dean Radin talked about this in my conversation with him, and that he finds that probably the main quality that seems to determine whether they see a measurable effect with intention in the lab is the capacity to focus, to have a single-minded intention or goal in the experiment, which is one reason why they've chosen to use, you know, very experienced meditators in their parapsychological experiments. So he says that, you know, many times we're just trying to do too many things at the same time. We're trying to multitask and multifocus, and that seems to blur our capacity to have a, you know, a clear intention or a clear effect in the world.
Well, one might also define that as both beings are conscious. It's just one is conscious that he's conscious, and the other is not. It's sort of like liberals and conservatives living in the same neighborhood. They cancel each other's votes out, and so nothing really is gained in the neighborhood. But I see exactly what you're meaning, that In order to change the average of a population, you really have to change a significant number of the population in order for when they're all added together and divided by the number of the total of the universe, which I don't know if that can even be numbered, but certainly from mathematics it can be considered conceptually, you would end up with an average. You would end up with the average consciousness of the universe or the average condition of the universe, and that's what you get. Plus or minus a little bit of standard deviation, but it's not going to move much unless you enlighten a significant portion of the population. In other words, teach them to meditate, teach them to focus, and teach them why they're focusing. Not what to focus on, but why they're focusing and what the results of that focus might give them in their lives. And I would maintain that it wouldn't take everyone, but it would take a critical mass, somewhat like helium freezing. It just doesn't happen a molecule at a time. It happens suddenly, as though some critical condition is reached and then it freezes. But we don't really understand why that happens. But it's probably the same thing in human conditions too. And I would say maybe that dolphins and whales probably have a consolidated mindset. I don't think they're enemies or divided mindsets. I think they probably are even one mind. But humans certainly are not. Just if you don't believe me, take a break and watch Fox News for 5 minutes and then come back. And I promise you'll see.
This is Jim. You know, the phenomenon that you described with helium is known as a phase change, when water turns to ice or water turns to a gas. And the sort of secret ingredient, the secret ally, I guess, we have in terms of actually achieving progress in terms of consciousness, the secret ally is technology. Because as we were discussing a little while ago, the internet has changed everything, and it's going to continue to change our ability to act collectively, I believe.
Very much so. I mean, you look at how elections are run in this country, and the internet has changed all that. I mean, people's opinions are transmitted instantaneously over the globe, and that's, you know, the feedback loop is just so much shorter than it used to be. And so you have a system which is constantly, you know, refreshing itself with, you know, more and more information, and so it's basically feeding back faster and faster.
Yeah, I'm always interested in statistics. One of the most famous statistical groups out there is Gallup, and they'll say, well, so and so is ahead by 2 points, but that's within the margin of error. Well, I would maintain that margin of error is beginning to look like the pendulum of a grandfather clock, because the collective viewpoint is vacillating so quickly now, based on moment-by-moment communication, blogging, news groups, even emails are becoming viral. Even Facebook is becoming viral. Little bits of information that can really, really change the fence riders, which is, you know, where all elections are won and lost anyway, kind of like basketball games, as great as the competition is, are won and lost at the free throw line, not really on the field of play. And that's what's happening, I think, and I agree totally with Jim and Steve that we're forming a new neural network across this planet. By the way we communicate, send ideas back and forth, and even the availability of new knowledge. And I think you guys agree with that.
Yeah. And, you know, the figure who really anticipated this was Teilhard de Chardin, who was a French priest who had this idea of he didn't know about the internet, but he called it the noosphere. And the concept was that humanity itself was kind of on a pathway to becoming something that closely resembled a superorganism, like a single brain, if you will.
Wow. So when we compare the will and desire of the consciousness of mankind, it seems to be much more elaborate and self-centered than do the other conscious beings of our world. Like you mentioned the primates and we mentioned cetaceans. We can speak in complex terms and even abstracts. We can form opinions, grudges, and even go to war with one another by dehumanizing other beings. What would you say that mankind at least participates in the creation of the universe in real time?
In terms of thought turning into reality? Is that
right.
The direction
you're
going
in? Thought turning into reality in terms of creation of the environment. And I'm going to call it a consciousness environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that depends on, you know, what's the exact nature of the mind-matter interface. How does mind actually influence matter, especially if this idea of continuous creation is always happening? How does mind, or how do our collective minds, you know, influence what's coming into manifestation in the universe? So that's, you know, at a very subtle level. But at a more global level, you know, we are collectively making choices that are essentially directing the future of life on this planet. I mean, I think that's a profound insight, that basically the choices we make collectively as a culture are really directing, determining the future direction of life on Earth in a big way. And that's something that
I agree with that on one sense, you know, paper or plastic or, you know, those kinds of choices, of course, are going to have an effect on the planet, whether we decide to save or spend, those kinds of choices. But, you know, for instance, Dr. Bruce Lipton, who's a molecular biologist, realized that after the Human Genome Project was wrapping up, that there weren't enough genes to account for the number of proteins in the human body. So
yes, it, correct.
That genes have a gamut of choices of proteins that they can make. And that choice of the DNA of which protein to make is based upon the environment. How much water you drink, how much sunlight you're exposed to, how much salt you intake, and also your consciousness. What he realized, and I don't think there's a single physician out there that doubts this, is that people that create a consciousness environment in their local biological transducer, their own body, of positiveness, of brightness, of being a benefactor or being merciful to one another, and to being self-centered in the sense that they love themselves and therefore it extends to others, are healthier than people who are always down on themselves and gossiping about others and woe is me and I'm sick all the time. And they are. And whether it's tumors being healed or just immune systems being refurbished and recovering from things like AIDS and leukemia, it is proven over and over and over again that the consciousness creates an environment in which genetic choices are being made on a molecular biological level we couldn't possibly have access to with our conscious mind, but our subconscious, our consciousness, is affecting that choice. So I'm trying to get at the, not the biophysical, but maybe the astrophysical or even the atomic level. Is consciousness involved in that creation process? Are we changing our planet and our local environment based upon our consciousness as a race?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea. I mean, go ahead. I mean, the whole idea of Bruce Lipton's work of epigenetics, that we are, you know, basically not these isolated entities, but we are essentially, you know, a network of interrelations with our environment. And, you know, this is basically, you know, a basic tenet of many of these world spiritual traditions of, say, for example, Buddhism, where there's no such thing as, you know, an isolated entity. It's all a network of interrelatedness. And I think this is one aspect of what we're discovering, is that we have deeper interrelations with, call it you know, the environment, whatever that is, that makes up the world around us, than we normally realize. So we had this idea that we're walking around as singular, isolated entities, and the research that we've been pointing to seems to call that into question.
Let me add to that, and something that you mentioned earlier about the fact that there's not enough coding DNA in our body to specify all of the complexity that we see manifested in a fully developed human being, particularly in the brain. What really happens is that through the process of development, the environment essentially acts as a sort of second genome, if you will, because the developing organism interacts not only with itself, but with its external environment. So that kind of becomes incorporated into the developmental program. And there's a sort of extended genotype, if you will, that augments the ability of our DNA to replicate.
I like that. I like that. You know, a lot of our listeners don't understand, or maybe you can't visualize it on the radio. You can't see how I'm holding my hands here behind the microphone. But these proteins unfold and go through a very complex duplication process, and then they wind back up again. And for a long time, well, not long time, but a significant time, we thought that there were mistakes in that unfolding and folding process, and that's where evolution came from. And we discovered, not in the too distant past, that that's absolutely impossible, that proteins just don't form that way. The first protein was definitely an engineered molecule, and that these differences that occur are not enough to cause jumps of species. But mild environmentally adaptations that take place during this folding, unfolding, and refolding of the protein, that environment is this environment in which this extra genotype takes place. And I'm going to ask you, maybe you could help us understand. We kind of have a rigid part, a very well understood part of our genotype as human beings, but we also have this junk area. We can't trace it to anything. Hair color, bone structure, eye color, fingernails, shapes of ears. We can't trace it to anything, and yet every human being has it. It's clearly obvious that we didn't evolve this extra DNA. It's baggage that we carry with us from the original design. Is it that DNA is it latent, or is it this DNA that is actually this extra genotype that makes us who we are?
It's a very profound part of it. That's an excellent, excellent question. The revolutionary work that's now being done in genetics is being done by the folks that are in a field called EvoDevo. And what they're discovering is that what was so-called junk DNA, which does not code for protein, is performing a very sophisticated function as essentially modulating the expression and the timing, particularly the timing of protein coding. It's the real software that's kind of running the system, and it's not junk at all. It's probably at least as important as the coding portions of our genome.
Wow, fascinating. And Bruce would also not let us overlook the cell wall, which is like those gates and channels he described in his book, The Biology of Belief. That extra nucleic knowledge, or some kind of EEPROM, like a little hard drive, is running on the outside of every single cell in our body, and it will run until that cell dies. The cell can protect itself against enemies, it respirates, it lives a normal life. It just can't replicate itself because all the genetic material is in the nucleus. But what an amazing machine. What a neat biological transducer. I just am so fascinated by it. I want to start over again and be a biochemist.
Yeah.
So it leads me to my next question. The anthropology of mankind is among the most debated subjects in science. The most recent observation is that the race is on the brink of an evolutionary shift. Do you think this is happening, and how?
Well, I think if what we've been talking about just now has any validity, then certainly, I mean, we're not only shaping our environment, but our environment is shaping us in, you know, probably quite profound and unrecognized ways. So many people would say that we're on the verge of something big, some, you know, quantum leap at a global level, and no one quite knows, you know, what's on the other side of that or what that's going to look like. But we can sort of see.
It's going to be a phase change, or are we going to sprout wings, or what's the next level?
It's a good question. I mean, we see that pretty much in every discipline, we're kind of on the edge of some profound understanding. I mean, certainly in astrophysics, you know, with these mysteries of dark energy and dark matter, they're pointing to something quite profound that we have yet to realize about the universe. And once we're on the other side of understanding what dark energy and dark matter are, we will almost certainly see the universe in a different way. And I think this kind of phase change is happening in many different areas of science and culture and society. You know, people
one of the ones in addition. Yeah, excuse me, Steve. Well, one of the areas where it's happening is in the area of computer science, and Ray Kurzweil calls this looming phenomenon the singularity, and that's a hypothesized moment when essentially artificial intelligence breaks through and acquires transhuman capacities. So that's certainly one area where people think that something big, as Steve put it, something big it lies ahead.
Yeah, and also to follow on Jim's comment that, you know, Kurzweil's idea of singularity is also the merging of the inanimate and the animate, right? And that's it. I think that's correct, isn't it, Jim? The machine and the human come together in a new way that we have a hard time conceiving of yet.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't think it's just me, because I see it pretty much, I travel a lot, and I see it pretty much everywhere. I don't see people aging the same way as they used to age. I mean, you know, when my parents were in their mid-50s, I mean, they were done. They were just finished. They were tired and wrinkly and got sore and broke bones. And my goodness, forget about getting out and playing singles tennis or 18 holes of golf. Today, you know, 55, 58, 59-year-olds look like 40-year-olds. They just, it's almost wholesale. I just don't see people aging the same as they used to. Is the race beginning to go through an anthropomorphic physical change?
It's a good question. And, you know, at least from my own perspective, I think our outlook makes a huge difference in terms of how vital we are at these different ages.
Well, define outlook.
Well, in other words, people 50 years ago only expected to live to be, you know, 60 or 70. And so there was this unconscious belief that, oh, you know, I'm pushing 60 now, I'm at the end of my life. You know, is there in some way a self-fulfilling prophecy in that? I mean, are their bodies, in a sense, responding to that belief that they're actually winding down towards the end of their lives? Nowadays, I mean, the average life expectancy is so much longer that, you know, 40 and 50 is barely the halfway mark. So it could be a whole different mindset, and maybe that's actually having effects on the body, you know, at a physiological level. Maybe we're not used to the idea that, oh, perhaps our ideas about aging and death are actually having an effect on our bodies aging and death.
Wow.
You know, there's a wonderful, the subtitle of my friend Ray Kurzweil's, one of his books is how to live long enough to live forever, because he believes that we're really on the verge of achieving what some call escape velocity, in terms of you know, really prolonging longevity to what might be called biblical limits.
Well, yeah, the idea that, which I think is pretty universal, it's even pretty much universal in Christianity, at least old Christian writings. Some of the more modern stuff in the 1700s, they conveniently erased it. But the idea of reincarnation, that the soul lives forever once it's created. Obviously, we've discussed tonight that souls are continuously being created, and at this moment on the earth, there are very young souls and very ancient souls existing at the same time. And it could be said that in every age, there are a handful of these very ancient souls that kind of keep the world together. The Da Vinci's, the Machiavelli's, the, you know, Michelangelo's, the Einstein's, although that kind of went in the wrong direction in 1945. Anyway, the idea is that this escape velocity is reached when one mortal body is somehow transformed, not through the act of death, but through the act of what those in the esoteric community call ascension, where the mortal body transforms into an eternal form. Yes, you can still be run over by a car, you can be poisoned, blah, blah, blah. But if you take care of yourself, the body does continue to regenerate, and the aging switch is turned off, and you can be Methuselah-like. And one would say, well, the planet is not ready for that. I mean, the fastest growing group of Americans in the U.S. today are the over 100 group. But if the U.S. and other nations don't get a handle on reproduction and longevity is continually extended, say, to 150 years or 200 years, then we're on the verge of overpopulating our planet. And nothing is absolutely true. There's no deviation from that. We do need to become a wiser and more conservative race, in the sense that we have to take care of our world and not destroy it like those who are not conscious that they're destroying their environment by overpopulation. The excretion of waste and the using of raw materials, we then become a planet of hunter-gatherers. And you realize that good worlds are hard to come by. So we might as well take care of this one, monitor what we have, and have as many coming in as we have going out, or spread the heck out and quit making these urban sprawls like New York and L.A. and Mexico City. My next question is, do you think the social forces on the planet today are enough to make this change? Or do you think, like the ancients, that there is some cycle of Earth travels in the cosmos that expose us to various DNA switching energies? Or do you think that these social energies are enough? The ancients kind of believed this. We traveled through the precession that our solar system reaches certain neighborhoods where energies interact with the biological and even the mental. These, as you said, ideas come pouring into the earth, and they're received by various peoples in different ways, be they music or mathematics or architecture or mechanics. And there was the maintenance, at least in some of the old writings, that we go through these ages of iron and bronze and gold and so forth. Do you think there's anything to that, or is that just a pattern of sociology?
You know, it goes back to the idea of how we perceive time. You know, many cultures perceive time very differently than we do. You know, in the West, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we have the idea of linear developmental time. But for many indigenous cultures, time is cyclical, or spiral, or has some other shape. And so it's a good question, you know, is there a developmental process or developmental direction to the universe? And I think we could say, you know, at least from the perspective of science and maybe sociology, that there is, you know, increased complexity, increased awareness. There's some process of evolutionary development and complexity happening over time, and perhaps it's taking place at a social level as well. Maybe global communications is a part of that, is an aspect of some new social organization that has yet to emerge.
Well, speaking of cycles, there are a lot of cycles that aren't acting the way they ever have before. For instance, the absence of sunspots, the very low solar wind that we have been experiencing for the last 3 or 4 years is allowing our heliosphere to be encroached upon by a galactic wind, which may carry a different message. In the meantime, we'll go ahead and take about a 4 or 5 minute break, get some water in our systems, and we'll be back for our final hour. Stephen Martin, Jim Gardner, the book is Cosmic Conversations. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're so glad that you're here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from the foothills of the Smokies. It's kind of an interesting place in the country where the winters are very mild. And also the summers aren't too bad either. A little bit of humidity, but if you plan on coming out here and buying a place, which wouldn't be a bad idea, it's kind of one of those developing areas in the country. Be advised, you don't want to come out here and buy 10 or 20 acres because there's a thing called the wilderness and you'll have to beat it back with a stick. It spontaneously generates. So unless you have a diesel-powered six-cylinder mower, I wouldn't recommend it. The Ark of Millions of Years is fast becoming the world's best source for 2012 events. used by universities as a textbook series, the three-volume set is now available as a packaged trilogy. If you order now, you also will get the first two volumes as free audiobook downloads. So if you're not a huge reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you. The Origin and Destiny of the Earth, all the way through the 2012 End Times, and a bonus. It is not all doom and gloom. Find out how to use the Law of Attraction to end the scarcity in your life. Order your copy today. All you have to do is go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Arcofmillionsofyears.com, that's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark. Real quick update on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We do have a couple of benefactors that are giving a strong look at the business plan, so all is not lost. We may yet be able to conduct this expedition above the Arctic Circle to discover, among other things, if the Earth is hollow or not. All theories deserve thorough investigation and experimentation. Just staggers my mind that no one's been above the Arctic Circle and conducted any experiments to prove or disprove the theory. Edmund Halley would be proud of us. So hang in there, and now we'll see what we can do about it. We'll be back in 40 seconds with more Cosmic Conversations. Stephen Martin and Jim Gardner will be back.
Life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
You do not have to be a physicist to join our conversation tonight, or a nanotechnologist. Might help to be an auto mechanic, but you can certainly join us toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-228-4494. And if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us on planet, off planet, makes no difference to us, 530-776-5154. Welcome back to the program, gentlemen. This is our final hour, and we take off all the gloves here. We just go try to draw it as far out as we can, and sometimes our callers hang out and write down their questions and put them against their refrigerators with magnets, and then they call in this hour. The question is, why do we need to go beyond contemporary science to understand the universe fully?
Well, I think we're getting indications that the universe is more than what our current theories describe it as. You know, for example, we talked about this earlier, that quantum mechanics seems to imply the need to understand consciousness as part of our research protocol. The other thing is that many of my contributors to the book talk about the primacy of consciousness in our experience. In other words, behind every experiment, there's an experimenter. And until we understand the subjectivity of that experimenter, in other words, the nature of that consciousness that's making these experiments, we still will have something missing from our theories about the universe, because it seems to be a very essential and necessary element for a full and complete understanding of what the universe is.
Let me add one thing, too. Paul Davies, the distinguished astrophysicist who won the Templeton Prize, said once that the biggest of the big questions is, why is the universe life-friendly at the most basic level? Why are the parameters of physics set and structured in just such a way to make it possible for carbon-based life to emerge? And science hasn't a clue, current science, contemporary science, hasn't a clue about how to answer that question.
Well, yeah, and there are a couple of arguments in the sense that, you know, stars emit what they emit because it's constructively interfering with the universe, and any other basis of life, be it silicon or whatever, is destructively interfering with the universe, and so thus can't get a foothold. So the one would maintain that this is the only kind of universe that could form.
That's one possibility.
Yeah, and as it turns out, that, you know, stars themselves are very finely tuned in their relationship with life. You know, people have talked about the fine-tuning constants of the universe, that if certain fundamental quantities, physical quantities, were even a smidge different by a factor of, you know, billionths, stars would either burn out too quickly or they wouldn't form fast enough, and conscious life like ours couldn't exist. So there's some way that our being here as living beings is saying something about the global properties of the universe.
Well, let's narrow it down to the planet itself. I mean, let's look at Earth. If we looked at Earth itself instead of the whole universe, we would look at it as this little jewel floating around in the cosmos of space, amazingly unique compared to any planet that we can find, Kepler mission notwithstanding. And it could make the case that it is the presence of our consciousness that allows the planet to form in this manner, to be in this distance from the sun, to have this amount of oxygen, to have liquid water and full of life and have an ecosystem operating, because we are symbiotic consciousnesses with the planet itself.
And many people, you know, have said, you know, we are basically the Earth, you know, walking around in human form. Because if you think, our bodies are essentially composed of everything we ate, and everything we've eaten has come to us from the Earth itself. So people talk about humans as being, you know, a new stage in the Earth's evolution, you know, as are, you know, whales and dolphins and all these other beings that we share the Earth with. These are all different manifestations of the Earth, you know, showing themselves up in different ways.
Sure, sure. And so the peas and carrots that make up our human body are entangled with the Earth, and therefore the rhythms and vibrations, and one could even say the Earth might be, heaven forbid, alive. Its consciousness is interacting with the matter that makes up our bodies, which is interacting with our environment. And our consciousness is interacting with the matter that makes up our bodies, which is interacting with the planet. So I guess my question is, if we're all friendly and loving, does the planet have one reaction? And if we're warlike and primitive and despondent, does the planet have another reaction?
It's a good question, you know. And if we take care of the environment, does the planet have a certain reaction? If we do not take care of the environment, you know, are we in danger of being extinguished, you know, for the protection of the whole? That's another theory that I've heard. And it's difficult to say. I mean, we are humans who are, I guess, encapsulated in a particular perspective, just learning about this much more global perspective. And I think this is where we can actually turn to indigenous cultures who have had this more holistic perspective of the Earth as a living being and as the source of our existence for millennia. And there's much that they have to teach us, as do, you know, as do the ancients as well.
You know, the atmospheric scientist James Lovelock has something he calls the Gaia hypothesis. And it seems he's encountered great derision. This is the concept that the Earth and its atmosphere and its seas are essentially are in a sense alive. It's a large living ecosystem. And for the life of me, I can't understand why anyone would regard that idea as controversial. It seems so patently obvious.
Well, it does to me as well. I mean, I love to fly. When you look down on the Earth and behold the way that it all fits together, and the fact that it seems to be at least two different ages. For instance, you look at the dry land where the mountains are, the Appalachians, the Rockies, the Blue Ridge, the Cascades. You look at the age of those formations, somewhere around between 4 and 4.5 billion years old. But then you look at the seafloor, and it's only 70 million years old, and some of it's as young as 10 million years old. So you're saying, well, okay, there's probably at least two different strata of ages of matter that make up this planet. Or one could even argue that there's two levels of matter to the Earth, that there's a higher level, a spirit matter, a consciousness higher, a vibrational matter to the Earth that has thought, although at a much lower frequency than ours, somewhere around, 14.8 hertz or something like that. And then there's the physical part, the rock part that seems inanimate and immovable and eternal. And it's not unlike the way we're put together. I mean, we have this physical part, which is, you know, the proteins that make up our body and fats and water. And then we have the animated part on the inside, the part that looks back at you in the mirror. I mean, we're just like the planet, and we have a rhythm with the planet. When we're taken off planet, we have an allergic reaction. I guess the bottom line is, are we an infection or are we a symbiont?
You know, I would hope that we're a symbiont, you know, that we have the capacity to recognize ourselves as part of this interrelated system and contribute constructively to it. You know, much of the, you know, ecological crisis, I think, stems from our inability to align ourselves with, you know, the natural phenomena that we see around us. We keep wanting to sort of push away and say, oh, you know, we're separate from all that. When really it's not such a bad thing to, you know, be of the earth. You know, I think it's quite a compliment.
I think so, too. And by the way, it's getting better. I've been to China and, you know, the coal-fired plants are shut down and they're running nuclear, and most of the vehicles are now electric or quickly going that way. They're far ahead of us as far as being able to make moves to protect the planet on a wholesale level. The worst I've seen is in Nepal. It's just, you know, open sewage compared to the rest of the world. But maybe one day they'll get there. My question is that we have a living planet with an extensive communication grid around it. We have a super organism known as the human race that is forming a new neural net, almost not quite thinking as one, at least exchanging ideas as one. And if we can open the lines of communication to the point where conflict disappears, at least on a warlike level, then maybe we've made the move to a new race. One of our listeners raises the question, when 2012 occurs, the Mayans believe that some kind of metamorphosis, some kind of dimensional shift is going to occur with planet Earth. Do you think that the type of humans and the number of humans on the Earth is coincidental or... let's see, what is this word? I think what he's trying to say is, do you think it's coincidental or do you think it's part of the purpose of the metamorphosis of the planet that we are all here now?
Good question. I think we are seeing, you know, changes, as we talked about, in every aspect of our culture. And, you know, Jim referred to this earlier when he talked about Teilhard's idea of the noosphere, right? Some new dimension of consciousness that seems to be emerging on a global level. So, you know, are we seeing the birth of some kind of new planetary consciousness? That's an interesting idea. And whether that correlates with an exact date of 2012 or not, I don't know. But something new does seem to be happening. I mean, this, you know, global interrelatedness, the global networking that seems to be emerging here may have emergent properties that we have yet to see. And will this show up in terms of a fundamental change in humanity? I think it's anyone's guess. But like any transformation, you know, I don't think the butterfly could have ever seen itself coming when it was a caterpillar. We really don't know what we're going to look like on the other end of this transformation. But I think everyone would agree that something fundamental is happening. something big is in the air. But the speculation is, you know, rampant in terms of what that's going to look like and what are the implications. We're really, you know, deeply in the midst of it, where we probably won't have the perspective until we're well beyond it. And it could be decades or even centuries until we have the perspective of what we're actually involved with right now.
Yeah, it could be. You know, one could argue that there are 7 billion of us on the planet now, and I don't think there's any historical evidence that there have been this many humans on the planet at the same time. I don't know what the largest the population was, but it could be argued maybe 500, 600, maybe 700 million people stably for thousands of years. But more humans are alive and conscious and moving around and breathing and interacting with the planet now than have ever done so. The idea that we're alive and we're purposeful and we're desiring and we're loving and we're having this, I'm going to call it an anxiety, not in the sense that we're nervous, but that we're anxious about something. We anticipate that something either marvelous or terrible is about to happen. It's like, you know, waiting for the bottom of the ninth in a tied game in Yankee Stadium. It's something big is going to happen, and we don't know what. And we want to be ready for it, but maybe, just maybe, we're the ones that manifest it. Now, what are the possibilities if that is true?
Well, that was a theme with many of the interviews I conducted, in that the future we encounter, you know, is really, in many ways, our choice. That it really is up to us in a collective way in terms of what future we choose. And, you know, that struck me as significant, that, you know, we have this collective capacity for choice that heretofore has gone unrecognized, I think, and is still unrecognized by many of us, that we're actually collectively making these decisions, that we're collectively shaping the future together. You know, and as you point out, we don't know what the effect of 7 billion people on the Earth making choices has. You know, it's an experiment that's never been done before in the whole history of the Earth. You know, this time has never happened. And so
that's exciting stuff. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think that Steve's absolutely right. The other thing that I would add is that biological creatures are potentially not the only entities that are participating or participants in this process of kind of coaxing the emergence of the butterfly, to use Steve's analogy. There is a series of projects. The most prominent is going on right now at Lausanne, Switzerland, to actually build a complete computer simulation of the human brain. And there are some indications that emergent properties, something that looks very much like a corollary, that looks very much like the same brain patterns you get when a person is conscious, is starting to emerge in that computer. So we may have some helpers in bringing about and coaxing the emergence of the future.
Wow. Now that's exciting stuff. Of course, now this all flies in the face of dogma, not necessarily spirituality. I want to draw a powerful contrast here between spirituality and religion. Many would have us believe that we are marching inexorably down the path of eschatology, and we will all end up in Armageddon or watching it on TV. We're maintaining tonight that it's our choice. We do not have to march any historical orders to their fruition. It is our choice. We are the creators of, or at least co-creators with our own planet, as to where this planet goes and what it becomes. And the fact that our 7 billion consciousnesses are alive and slowed down to this moment, not traveling at the speed of light like a photon, observing this as one more flash of light. But we have slowed it down to the point where we can actually see the seedling bursting through the ground and rising in slow motion in a solar tropic manner, coming to its full flowery beauty. and we're experiencing every single moment of it, and hopefully we're enhancing it with our own beauty and our own creative ability. And I think that's what we're talking about here tonight. And I think that's the theme of where the cosmic conversations went. Am I right?
Well, very much so. And just to kind of piggyback on what Jim said, I mean, here's an example of where we're basically collaborating, or we're co-creating with the universe. I mean, that we're building, you know, machines or computers or virtual environments that are getting so sophisticated that these emergent properties are also collectivizing along with us in this creation. So in this sense, you know, we're the handmaidens of the universe, you know, bringing the inanimate into animation. In other words, bringing the inanimate to life in a new way.
Wow.
I think that's such a powerful idea.
It is. And that's very profound.
Something you said, it very similar at the beginning. Ray Kurzweil calls this process is transforming lifeless matter into what he calls computronium, where in effect the entire cosmos becomes a vast thinking brain.
Computronium, yeah. As opposed to governmentium.
Yes, I prefer computronium.
Yeah, I like it. So do you think then that the universe actually is alive?
Not yet, but it's coming to life. And we're sort of the leading edge of bringing it to life, if you will.
Do you think we're about to join a galactic community and that we're being observed somehow like a toddler ready to take his first steps?
Perhaps. That is the so-called zoo hypothesis to explain the great silence, why we don't seem to have received ET signal yet. But that certainly is one very seriously proposed possibility.
Yeah, and the other idea is that maybe these dynamics that we're participating in aren't just confined to our isolated corner of the cosmos. That maybe these kinds of dynamics where the inanimate, you know, somehow becomes sentient and contributes to its own evolution take place everywhere in the universe. So we could be in a universe that's teeming with life.
Well, at least we see the evidence of it here on our world. And when these ideas go out, and they have their time, it can be argued that they exist all the time. They're just kind of out there ringing in the white noise, and somebody just happens to hear the note and know how to make it into physical. But it can also be argued that these things come along as sort of a string of messages or ideas or concepts, and they're not all present all the time. And that when they come along, certain individuals, I think everybody hears it. It's just some people say, "What was that?" And another person says, "Oh, wow, what was that?" Big difference in attention. And the information goes into their mind. They know what to do with it because of who they are, who they have aged to be, and what their skill sets are. And they're able to turn it into computronium and help us get to the next level of thinking. We've been, and of course our generation, we think of things in binary terms, ones and zeros, which would be completely foreign to someone born in the 1800s or even early 1900s. But what happens when we go to trinary logic or quaternary logic? The possibilities boggle the mind. In fact, they are the mind. The human mind operates on many, many different levels, musical and artistic and colors and shades and forces and even emotions tied in there with it. Computers historically have not been able to do that. They run whatever program you put in there, and as long as you're hitting the letter G, it goes through whatever that signal is and puts a G on your page. But it doesn't think, per se. Now they're getting to the point where they're beginning to think. That's a big difference than computing.
It certainly is. I mean, some of these computers are composing music, you know, and some of it is actually, you know, listenable to. So I think we're just at the stage where we're basically pointing in the direction where things could go. And we're just sort of seeing the hints of the kind of emergent complexity that could take place. You know, once machines and once artificial intelligence, you know, reaches a particular level.
Sure, sure. I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, this computer can compose music. But on the other hand, can it look at a star-spangled sky and compose music?
Good question.
We just don't know.
Yeah.
But we're about to find out.
Exactly.
Wow. Are you involved with that at all? Are you observing it? Are you on the Christmas card list? I mean, how soon are you going to know whether this thing is working or not?
Just observing it.
Interesting. Well, yeah. that would be a neat one to have on the program. You know, the network is absolutely packed with people right now, but no calls. And sometimes our listeners sit out there with their jaws on the floor and just listen because they think, oh, my gosh, I don't have anything to contribute to this. And they just listen. And most of our listeners will actually listen tomorrow morning. They'll go to work and they'll load up X Squared Radio Archives, which will be up in about an hour after this program. And they sit there with their headphones on and work on blueprints or drawings or accounting or whatever, and they listen to the program. And then they'll write me the emails in. So we're going to get a lot of questions, and I'll send those on to you. And some of them are pretty profound. We have a very eclectic audience, sort of the upper echelon of what used to be the Art Bell audience that got disenchanted with the more bubblegummy conspiracy theory subjects that are out there now, and they want to hear the more scientific stuff, and so that's why we came to be. Do you think the universe, we asked the question if it's alive, let me ask you this, do you think the universe is intelligent?
Jim, you want to go ahead first?
Yeah, it is part and parcel of coming to life. This is the, you know, the basic element of my theory. Part and parcel of that is that the universe, through the medium of our minds and probably other minds scattered throughout the endless parsecs of space, is growing intelligent. But we are the mechanism. We are the intermediary. We are the tool by which the universe is becoming intelligent.
Yeah, and I would follow on that by saying, you know, the universe is increasing its intelligence over time. You know, some people would speculate that atoms, in terms of how they form combinations and molecules, are expressing a very basic level of intelligence. So perhaps intelligence, you know, is an entire spectrum of development over all the different stages of complexity of the universe. And perhaps the degree to which intelligence is evolving may be increasing over time. So perhaps the universe may be actually becoming more intelligent over time and more efficient and more perhaps elegant in terms of the patterns that it's creating over time.
And another way to put that is more and more of the sort of raw matter is being converted into computronium, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. The universe is thinking more about itself over time.
Yes.
Yeah.
At some point, the universe will state, I am.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, we do have a caller, Michael from Austin, Texas. You're on the program. Welcome.
Hey, Brooks. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm one of these people that have their jaw down on the floor, and I did real bad in science and math, and you know, I'm just a carpenter for a living, and an artist. But my question is, about consciousness is, how about dream consciousness and mirror consciousness being, you know, what we experience in our dreams over the accumulation of the time that we're in these bodies? That I don't know about you, but I just woke up in this body, you know, that's all I know. It's like, sometimes my fear is, you know, whatever brought me here is going to leave me here, but my dreams have been really powerful, but my life just stinks, but, you know, this mirror consciousness, this economic slavery that we're living in, you know, trying to, hold it all together with our jobs and our ability to galvanize some sort of cohesive, philosophies to live our daily in and out lives. We've got to all have to be at work in the morning and do our daily thing. How about our dreams and how our dream consciousness is all that really matters? And we open up our eyes and we put on our shoes and socks and, you know, we go out and we do our jobs and the daily grind of this serfdom that we're all subjected to. You know, isn't it just our dreams that matter and allowing the consciousness of our dreams to kind of seep into our waking reality instead of the nightmares sort of seeping into our waking life? So that's the only way I grasp it anymore, because this is all going on in between the space between my ears. That's all I know, and I know that that space between my ears is not about the ears. I kind of float this body, and I don't know how I got here. I just got all these rules in history that really don't work for me, and I know my dreams just, you know, take me back to, you know, just take it easy, man. But anyway, whatever it is you can tell me about my dreams and my dreaming consciousness as far as my waking consciousness in the discussion, I'd really like to hear some feedback on that, and enjoy listening to the show.
Great question. All of us put on that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks so much, Michael. Well, many cultures around the world hold dreams in a very, very sacred place in their culture. And, you know, I encountered this when I was talking to some indigenous peoples, and that, you know, in particular, I know in the African traditions, they consider the dream world to be more real than the physical waking world. And people have probably heard about cultures, dream cultures, where the first thing they do when they wake up in the morning is they gather as a council and they tell each other their dreams. Because in that sense, they're really relating to what's most important and most alive in them. And many of these cultures point out that we have capacities in our dreams that we simply can't do in our waking lives. You know, we're more free, we're using more of our potential in our dreams, that we really are these dreaming beings. And so I think you're onto something, and that your dreams may be giving you information that may not be coming to you in other ways in your conscious life. And I think that's something worth paying attention to. You know, what is the dreaming universe? You know, for example, the Aboriginal peoples of Australia talk about the dream time, you know, the space of, you know, all time and space where things are happening simultaneously, as being, of primary importance. So I think it's a very ancient idea that, you know, dreams have a reality of their own, and they're expressing something very fundamental and profound about the universe.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in indigenous peoples is they don't tend to do things during their awake time that take away from their dream existence. In other words, they don't engage in activities that require them to stop dreaming or require them to obfuscate what it is they're dreaming. They live their lives in such a simple manner that it doesn't encroach upon the dream world. We, on the other hand, do live very complex lives with complex interactions. We can become indebted and therefore enslaved to engaging in work that we hate, getting up every morning, driving to a place we don't want to be, getting out of the car, vomiting in the parking lot, and then going in and working for 8 or 10 hours so that we can have the exchange, which is money, so that we can do the things that we want to do, which are only with the disposable dollars, by the way, if there are any. Mm-hmm. And so we do engage in a lifestyle that takes away from the value of our dream state.
Yeah, and in that sense, we as a culture could cultivate this dream state much more comprehensively than we currently do. You know, for example, we tend to dismiss dreams in our culture. We say, oh, it's just a dream, you know, and we forget about it. But what happens if we, you know, start to encourage our dreams or our insights from our dreams to come into our waking lives, to sort of let that line be a little bit more blurred than it normally is? You know, what kinds of creativity, what kinds of insight might come into our lives if that happens? I mean, there's many examples throughout history of people receiving inspiration, you know, very creative inspiration in their dreams. For example, artists, you know, will often try to portray some of their dream images, and it's a rich source of creativity for them. So I think dreaming, you know, should be very much encouraged in our culture because it represents, I guess you could even call it, in many ways, the raw creativity of the universe. You know,
I could agree more. I reincorporated into my life something that I used to have in my life when I was in preschool, and that is the late afternoon nap.
Yeah.
It does a lot for the creativity, I can tell you.
Very much. I mean, I'm also a big advocate of naps, or simply taking time in the day to just simply relax and just be.
Yeah.
We're in a very doing culture. And just the art of being is something we can encourage much more than I think we currently do.
Very well.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for taking my call. If I could leave you with just one more question, in this discussion. So is our dream consciousness what brings us into this body consciousness? And if that's true, does our dream consciousness lead us, you know, onto the next experience, the next body, the next, you know, the next circumstances, the next karma, the next parents, the next whatever, just the next story that we're evolving ourselves in at this moment? Can it be just as crazy, you know, in just another dream? So, with that, good night, guys. I'm gonna get off the phone and listen to what you have to say about it. Brooks, I love the show. I look forward to seeing you up at James's Ranch.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you so much for the questions.
Take care now.
Okay. That's a good question. My goodness. Do our dreams, are they the driving energy that create or at least partly responsible for our life condition? That is to say, who we're born to and where we go from here. I would maintain that it's probably an agreement between consciousnesses. It's not wholly our decision, but more an agreement between, you know, several beings, this life condition, who we're born to and when. And it's a matter of availability and steric hindrance, which is a chemical term, which means not all reactions take place because you can't get all the atoms in the space that's allotted. So there's some steric hindrance, there's agreements, and there's symbiosis and even constructive interference on a quantum level that need to take place in order for things to manifest. They don't just pop into existence because we and we alone dream them unilaterally. At least those are my thoughts, guys.
Sure. And there may be, you know, subtle structures in consciousness that we may, you know, yet not be aware of. You know, I know that one of my contributors, Christopher Bache, is one of probably the foremost scholar on reincarnation. And, you know, he's really explored the idea that consciousness or the universe, you know, in its conscious form may be evolving and learning over time. And, you know, the reincarnation of consciousness may be a part of that. And, you know, certainly dreaming consciousness would play, you know, a big role in that as well. You know, from dreaming on to the much more subtle levels of consciousness. So I think it's an intriguing possibility.
Where do dreams take place in the mind, in the human brain? Do they take place in the cortex or?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's in the cortex.
You know, one of the Tibetan traditions, when you meet one another in a profound manner, not on the street, but if you really want to meet, is that you lean forward and touch foreheads and transfer as close as you can that dream energy between one another. And they even say one to another, Tasha Dele, which is, you know, the vocalization of the same thing.
And I think also in Tibetan, many forms of Tibetan Buddhism, there's also something called dream yoga, where they learn to basically lucid dream, to actually be conscious in their dreams, and to basically, I guess, co-create with their dreams. And that's a further development in consciousness, this capacity to actually be awake both in waking life and in dreaming life.
Exactly. That's what we've been doing in the last 3 hours. Let's see. We've tied spirituality and consciousness and science together. We've tried to explain that the best way that we can, and I apologize for using, you know, some of the terms that we use, but it's a shortcut for those of us in the scientific community. We don't want to show our work. We just want to go right to the answer. Many contemporary physicists are admitting that consciousness plays a role in the formation of matter itself from energy. Some are even in search of a definition or the derivation of a consciousness constant, as it were. After you conducted your interviews, what did you discover about the involvement of consciousness in the shaping of matter? I know we've talked about the creation of matter, but you know, just creating protons is one thing. Actually creating organized matter in the form of proteins or higher order elements or even molecules or even the manipulation of reactions with our consciousness. Do you find that there is evidence that this kind of observation affects those kinds of things?
It didn't quite come up explicitly in any of the conversations that I had, but you know, what was a recurring theme is that, you know, our intent does influence or shape the world in subtle ways. And so there could be all kinds of effects to that we have yet to discover. One thing, which makes sense to me, but I didn't quite realize at the time, is that Dean Radwin was pointing out that the brain, actually, at the molecular level, is a quantum system. In other words, at the level of ions below and below, you know, quantum mechanics dictates its functioning. And so therefore, the elements of the brain act like particles, but they also act like quantum waves, which basically, you know, extend, you know, the wave function extends as a potentiality over the entire universe. And yet the brain itself, you know, is this 3 pounds of matter which we carry around inside our heads. So, you know, what is the brain, and how does that actually influence consciousness is, you know, also a profoundly deep question.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I on the one hand think that flashlights are commonplaces to store dead batteries. and sometimes skulls are commonplaces to store inactive brains. I would challenge the listeners, and probably the listeners of this program are doing okay, but, you know, wake up your neighbor, because they're just packing around 3 pounds of gray matter in their skull, and they're not using it. Get them to read some more. Get them to listen to more complex music instead of what's coming off the FM radio. And get them to dream more. You know, I think the dream process is highly overlooked culturally in the West. In the indigenous peoples, perhaps it could be said their culture moves more slowly than ours, but not really so, because if you go back to the Babylonian seals, or you go to carvings in the Maya, or the Toltecs, or the Zapotecs, or the Olmecs, you see very, very high orders of understanding of the cosmos. And one could argue, oh, well, yeah, space aliens came here and taught them about the 9 planets of the universe, as they did with the Dogon Indians. But on the other hand, it could be just the dream state, just this quantum imagination, beholding the universe and then becoming convinced that's the way it is and then carving it in stone and leaving it for us. Like, see, we didn't even need polished glass to be able to see the Milky Way galaxy.
You know, the one other thing I wanted to mention, a lot of folks are not aware of this, but there's a very distinguished physicist, now very senior at Princeton, by the name of John Wheeler. He was the professor who had Richard Feynman, for instance, the Nobel Prize laureate, as his student, his graduate student. And he has developed a theory called something called the participatory anthropic principle. And it's a kind of a radical extrapolation from the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. And it basically asserts that the very act of observing the universe summons it into existence and gives it shape. And this is a mainstream guy.
John Wheeler's like, you know, the postulate guy. He's the guy that everybody uses to form their theories.
And so that idea is actually gaining now some new credence with people like Paul Davies. So it really does respond very directly to your question of whether or not the act of consciousness and conscious observation has a global effect on the state of the cosmos. And the other element of that that's so interesting is that he hypothesizes that it actually operates backwards in time. It has a kind of retroactive causation feature, and that because the vast majority of time is future time, on a cosmic scale, the acts of observation that will occur billions of years hence by presumably, you know, vastly powerful forms of intelligence are actually shaping our reality.
Of course.
And again, this is a mainstream guy.
That was the participatory
anthropic principle. In other words, that we participate in creating this life-friendly cosmos.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you think of it, okay, the formula of a cone, okay, is something pi over 12. And it's an expanding diameter out into space from some point, okay, the volume of a cone. And the volume of a parabolic cone has 8 in the denominator instead of 12, so somewhat truncated diameter, maybe decreasing a little bit. The idea that the future is the potential of all potentialities, less our restrictions that we put upon it. For instance, I want $1 million, but that's not really what I want. What I want to do is do something with $1 million, but I've now forced the universe into delivering my end goal by giving me $1 million. So I've somewhat truncated the potential of all potentialities. And I have observed that reality out there, and so in doing so, the universe is somewhat resonating with it or not. But the past has already been experienced by me, so it's more tubular in shape and not conic in shape. And it's not a line, because I can go back and observe the past and actually change it. The idea that time is non-local, and therefore this anthropic principle is retroactive, in the sense that I am now affecting the present by going back and changing the past, the present being the future to the past, and the future being the future to the present.
Yes.
It's really an amazing concept, but you must be aware of your presence in those places, or your effect is completely accidental.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
And it was single people doing it is one thing, but groups of people and a race doing it, the possibilities are absolutely endless. We can go anywhere and be anything and direct ourselves as sentient beings anywhere we want to be. And I would maintain that we directed ourselves to be here, because this is an amazing place to have a mortal experience.
Yeah, and that resonates very much. Yeah, it resonates very much with the idea that consciousness may not be bounded by time and space in the way that physical phenomena are. And that seems to be what's coming out of the parapsychological experiments, is that, you know, time and space may not be limitations for consciousness. And so this overthrows our ideas about causality, right? We have this old linear model of causality, you know, A causes B, and, you know, A is the past, you know, which caused the present. But the idea
only in the sense that A is before B.
Right.
You know?
Right.
If we, it's a shell game for our consciousness. And if becomes cyclic and we actually get good at meditating and going back and correcting or, shall I say, reobserving things that have happened in our past and how those things affected us.
Yeah.
And then we change our own mirror. We change our own structure. And therefore, we evolve once again from the same past we already experienced. And that evolution then affects the past.
Right. Right.
I like it. Wow. I told you this third hour is, you know, better have your seatbelts fastened because it could go places. No idea it could go there. So in your dreams, do you fly?
I have. It's a wonderful feeling. In fact, I'd like to do it more.
How about you, Jim? Do you fly in your dreams?
Yeah, I try. I have actually had the dream that sort of echoes, you know, Einstein's thought of flying alongside a light beam and trying to imagine what that would be like.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I mean, that is what really makes us, I think, makes us scientists. And I think Michael, even though he drives nails for a living, really thinks like a scientist, and I think that's his dream. He just maybe needs to lay down the hammer and pick up a calculator for a while and go back to school, because that's where he should be. And maybe he will. I went back to college at 38, and gosh, look what happened. I'm unemployed. I'm kidding. anyway, it's fun to be on radio. I only do this 3 hours a week. It's a hobby because I really get to speak to neat people like Steve Martin and Jim Gardner, and the profound thinkers, productive writers, and it has been an absolute pleasure having both of you on the program tonight. And I know, you know, as people, I don't know, 5 or 6 million people listen to this program in the next 6 or 7 days, they'll be moved by it, and they'll pick up the book Cosmic Consciousness. It's available at Amazon.com. It would be helpful if you pushed it into the top 100, because both men would like to be Amazon bestsellers. It is easy to read because it's an interview form. It's a series of interviews with profound thinkers like Fred Alan Wolf and others, some of whom you know and some of whom you do not, but will if you read the book. The pieces are fairly short and so can be digested in a few trips to the restroom, if that's where you want to put the book. And certainly will open your mind to think about life and maybe even death on several different levels. Certainly your effect at your workplace and in your family. And I think it's a profound book, well worth owning and reading again. Gentlemen, it's been a distinct pleasure having you on the program. I want to stay in touch, and maybe we'll trade some emails and some ideas.
Sounds good. It's been a pleasure for me too, Brooks. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely my pleasure. I'll send the message along to your publicists as well that we had a great time. It's rare that I get to talk at, you know, in this level, and I'm not sure that I impressed either one of you, but I was certainly impressed by both of you.
A great
Thank
pleasure.
You. Yeah.
All right. Thank you both, and good night. Have a wonderful week, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Good night, all.
Good night. So, Earth Explorers, as you think about the purpose of life, the purpose of the universe, your purpose in it, realize that there are others thinking about it, and you're not alone, and do not despair. We're at a time of the year when despair is easy, as we're getting toward the close of the year and you're wondering about your productivity or your purpose in life. Don't despair, because others are thinking about the same things that you're thinking about, and there are excellent books written on the subject. Pick it up, read about it, and improve your life, improve your dreams above all, and be well. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.